Thank you very much for having me here. It's a great pleasure to be here, well, at PI for the first time. So today I'm going to talk about galaxy surveys and some fundamental physics we can do with it. So the general, let's say, umbrella of the research I'm doing in this particular instance is large gas structure cosmology. It's a very exciting field where many different methods come together. So this is a data-driven field, so obviously we have big data. We have galaxy surveys, you know, we have data sets that have millions of observables, millions of spectra, and so on. Then we use a combination of tools to analyze it. We use a lot of theoretical calculations, so Feynman diagrams that we'll know and love. We also use a lot of numerics. Most recently, there was a big influx of machine learning methods. So you can see here, well, in this part of the slide, you can see some result of this numerical simulation that I'm going to talk in detail. And we do all these things to hopefully discover new physics. So that's the general, this Venn diagram gives, should give you a general idea of what is going on here. Okay, so my talk is going to be about cosmology. As you know, cosmology you know, has been a very exciting field over the last couple of decades. And thanks to tremendous observational and theoretical efforts, we've established a very coherent and clear picture of what happened to our universe. And well, this picture looks like this. It all started with something like inflation. So inflation is a primordial accelerated expansion of the universe that happened when the typical energies were as high as 10 to the 16 GeV. And then our universe was expanding and cooling down. At some point, it cooled down up to the point that the first atoms were created. And this gave us the cosmic background fluctuations. So you can see this picture in here. And you know, what's remarkable is that with the CMB, we see for the first time the snapshot of the perturbations that were seeded during inflation. So this is the very first snapshot of our universe. And then later on, the same fluctuations, they evolved into galaxies. And well, basically galaxies, they provide us with much more, you know, with many snapshots of the same fluctuations. And this is because galaxies, they, unlike the CMB, fundamentally they have a redshift associated with them. So we can create a whole three-dimensional map. It's like having multiple images of the CMB. So this gives us, you know, more snapshots. And we also have a standard model called Lambda CDM. So this is the model that basically says that the only thing that you need to explain all the snapshots is something like inflation, then something like cold dark matter, and then a cosmological constant to explain the recent accelerated expansion of the universe, and that's it. With these few ingredients, well, plus the standard model, then it's enough, you know, at least in order to explain everything. And, you know, this coherent picture, so it's very nice, you know, it explains most of the data that we have, but still it leaves us with many questions. Well, there are some known unknowns. So, you know, there are all these ingredients, like inflation, but we don't know what was inflation exactly, or if dark matter is really cold. So we have these sort of questions. And also, on top of that, we have unknown unknowns. So some surprises in the data, some discoveries. Well, recently we had one of these surprises in the context of the parity violation in the universe. That also was ruled out later. So I'll be very happy to discuss this recent unknown unknown, but we hope to see more unknown unknowns down the road. Okay, so let me say a few words about these different components that I mentioned. The first one is dark matter. So as you know, there are many pieces of evidence that point to dark matter. There are very dramatic pictures of you know, the rotation curves and strong gravitational lensing. But also they are this, let's say, boring pieces of data that we use to infer dark matter, such as the CMB and large gas structure. And by studying these, you know, fluctuations, we can actually, you know, we can get the strongest quantitative evidence for dark matter. So I'm showing you this pie chart that I'm sure you've seen many times that, you know, gives you a breakdown of different contributions to the energy density. And you see that dark matter has 26.8, so it's very precise. It has the 0.8. So the 0.8 comes from the CMB. So from this boring, you know, study of correlation functions of fluctuations. Okay. So and with large gas structures, so large gas structures, I'm going to tell you further, is also a great source of information, and hopefully, you know, we can learn more about dark matter, not only its total density. Now, in the context of dark matter, I like this, you know, it can be many things. I like this representation of dark matter candidates that I stole from Andrew Long, so that shows different houses. So each house, conda or a skyscraper corresponds to a particular dark matter candidate as a function of mass. And the only thing that we know about dark matter is that gravitates just like usual matter, but it doesn't interact with normal particles, so it doesn't shine. It could be all, you know, any of these possibilities, or maybe all of them at the same time. I feel like here I don't really need to motivate the particle physics, candidates, but basically any extension of the standard model automatically gives you a dark matter candidate. And that's why there are some other examples like primordial black holes, modified gravity, but I feel like, you know, we all hope that somehow dark matter will be a particle. All right. In terms of dark energy, also, you know, we have a very picturesque and, dramatic image of how it was discovered for the first time and how the Nobel Prize was awarded for it, how the supernovae were getting dimmer and dimmer. So here you can see one of the spots of the supernova dimming. And at the same time, we also can infer the effect of dark energy indirectly, again, through this boring observable CMB and Lasky structure. And again, we know that 68.3% of all energy density should be dark energy. And this 0.3 again comes from the CMB and Lasky structure. And in terms of physics, the most plausible candidate for dark energy is the cosmological constant. So, well, as you probably have seen, there is this great train somewhere in South America, possibly in Colombia, but I'm not sure, that has Einstein equations scribbled on it, but it misses the lambda term, okay? So we can add the lambda term back, and then this will be a great candidate for the cosmological constant. Now, there are also theories that basically say that dark energy could be not a cosmological constant, but in this case, I guess even more questions may arise. If you have a theory that explains the current accelerated expansion without a cosmological constant, that means the cosmological constant has to be zero, but, you know, cosmological constant being zero is as bad from a material point of view as like 10 to the 4 electron volts to the 4 power. So I don't know. I feel like even more questions arise. And that's why there are very intense efforts on the observational side to really verify that dark energy is a cosmological constant. Dark energy survey LSST that was supported in the most recent P5 report. So we're, making a lot of instrumental progress towards establishing the question of state of the dark energy. I can tell you maybe right now that to 1% precision, what we have right now, it is a cosmological constant. All right. And the last ingredient I want to say a few words about is cosmic inflation. So as I said, the cartoon picture of inflation was like this. So you can see here a balloon. So our universe, at the very beginning, before the Big Bang, it looked like this balloon that was inflated by, with help of a field called inflaton. And then little ripples on the surface of this balloon, their existence is guaranteed by quantum mechanics, by the uncertainty principle. And then these little ripples, as a result of this expansion, they became classical fluctuations that later sourced CMB and the galaxies. And when inflation was put forward for the first time, roughly 40 years ago, it resolved many many problems. In particular, I guess the most interesting problem is the problem of initial conditions that we see CMB alike, in all parts of the sky. And from the point of view of the hot Big Bang theory, this requires a tremendous fine tuning, because basically what you see is going to be different causally disconnected regions, and yet somehow they happen to have the exact same initial conditions. And inflation explains this in a very elegant manner. So I think that's why most of the people believe that something like inflation must happen. And from the theory side, we understand what inflation is also very precisely, at least its basic features. So the simplest model for inflation is a slowly rolling scalar field. So if you have some potential, V of phi here, and then we have a scalar field that rolls. It rolls very slowly, so it rolls so slow, so roughly it's a constant. You know, the potential energy is constant, kinetic energy is zero. So this gives, this acts like a cosmological constant, and then we have the accelerated expansion. So that's the basic mechanism that we need to have for inflation. And this mechanism is well understood, and how to produce generations is also, how to generate perturbations is also very well understood. However, there are many particle physics realizations. We don't know precisely which one is correct. And that's why there is a very strong push from the experimental side to check different, you know, signatures of various inflationary models. There is a nice document online called Encyclopedia Inflationaris that was actually written something like 10 years ago, and it contains over 120 different models that explain inflation. And also here you can see how the number of papers citing inflation or saying inflation in abstract is growing as a function of year. And you can see that 10 years ago there was a big spike that was associated with the Planck measurements of the CMB and primordial non-Gaussianity. Then it sort of went down because Planck didn't detect non-Gaussianity, but now it's going up again. And this most recent trend is produced by hopes that with Lashky structure, finally, we're going to pin down a particular particle physics model. And I'm going to...
Is that the bicep pump?
Well, it's hard. Well, you see, there are only two data points. Yeah. Well, maybe the first one is the Planck bump, and the second one is the bicep. Yeah, this is probably, yeah. Yeah.
Right. I never heard of that.
Okay. All right. So hopefully this trend will be more promising. Okay. And I'm going to. All right. Very good. So now let me say a few words about these measurements that we use to, you know, figure out things about dark matter and dark energy and inflation. So the workhorse of cosmology for the last couple of decades has been the cosmic microwave background. So here you can see the picture, you know, the cartoon of the Planck CMB fluctuation measurements as a function of sky coordinates. And what we see here is a random stochastic field that is nearly Gaussian. So all of its physical properties are encapsulated in the correlation functions. In this case, a two-point function, the power spectrum, CL. So CL is a function of the, you know, harmonic multiple number or the angle on the sky. And here I'm showing you the beautiful measurements of the CMB power spectrum made by Planck. And the first observation that you can make is that this spectral shape is very non-trivial, right? It's very tricky. It has a plot on large scales. It has some oscillations. You know, there is some sort of exponential cutoff. So it seems to be a very complicated shape. And it's very, well, the great success of the standard model is that you can fit this curve with only six parameters that I listed here. So it's the abundance of matter, abundance of baryons, the Hubble constant, which is roughly the age of the universe, then the tau, the optical depth. So this is considered to be an astrophysical parameter. And then we also have two parameters that characterize the amplitude and the tilt of the primordial power spectrum generated during inflation. So with these six parameters, you can fit the CMB power spectrum really well. And it's actually, you know, studying the deviations, you know, of the variation of the CMB power spectrum as a function of these parameters is exactly how we measure them. So here I'm showing you the cartoon, how the CMB power spectrum reacts to the change of the dark matter density. And well, there's only one snapshot here that matches this picture, right? And this is how we measure dark matter to how we get this 0.8%. All right. Now, with Lashky structure, in future, we want to do something very similar. So first of all, Lashky structure is very much like the CMB. So when we look at galaxies represent fluctuations of the cosmic density that you can parameterized by introducing the field delta, which is delta rho over rho. So it's a rho is a, let's say, average density of in the universe, and delta rho is a little local fluctuation. And you know, unlike the CMB, the galaxies give us the three-dimensional volume of information. So for instance, here you can see the actual, let's say, map of the universe created with a galaxy survey. So we have this z direction. So we reconstruct really three-dimensional distribution, and now we can use three-dimensional tools to parameterize it. So we use the two-dimensional powers, three-dimensional power spectrum as a function of the wave number. And also we can calculate higher order endpoint functions just because, again, the distribution of galaxies is a random stochastic field. And here you can see the measurement of the galaxy power spectrum from the Bose survey. And it also has some non-trivial shape, right? So it has some turnover. It also has some BE oscillations. So we could use it the same way as we do with the CMB. And here maybe let me visualize the data from the galaxy surveys. So those are this cartoon shows you the data from the efforts of SDSS over many years, different extensions, BOSS and EBOSS, and different colors. So each point here corresponds to a galaxy, and different colors, they show different types of galaxies. And altogether we have something like around 5 million galaxies in here, and you see how they map the universe. Well, the surface that was before is the CMB surface. Well, here you can see all these beautiful structures that we can resolve, like the filaments and the clusters. And overall, these observational efforts with Bose and SDSS allowed us to map the cosmic evolution over a time scale of 10 billion years. So now maybe you will.
Can I ask a dumb question? Why are there gaps? Are these because they are not full sky surface, this guy?
Exactly, yeah. So the most prominent gap is because of our galaxy that is here. It's also in the CMB, you see. This is our galaxy that is here. Yeah, so this is the first source of the gaps. And the second is that it's a ground telescope, right? As Jess says, a ground telescope. So it only has access to one particular part of sky. All right, yeah, here you can see we trace it back to 12 billion years, look out time. All right, so this is our data set. And now, let me just say that I'm developing this idea of the full shape analysis. So this is really the way to think about the galaxy distribution exactly the same way as we used to think with the CMB, about the CMB. Just let's extract all these correlation functions and fit directly their shape as a function of cosmology, and extract things like dark matter density and so on and so forth. And it seems to be a good idea because CMB and large scale structure, they are highly complementary. They probe different scales, they probe different redshifts, and also they're sensitive to different physics. In particular, there is a Weinberg theorem. Well, Weinberg had many theorems, but there is one theorem about dark matter that basically tells you that the CMB, the primary CMB fluctuations, decouple from dark matter. They only feel dark matter at the background level, not the dark matter fluctuations. Whereas with galaxies, we probe directly dark matter fluctuations. So here we see baryons, here we see dark matter. So this is one of the reasons why we expect to get really some great information about dark matter from galaxy surveys. And as I mentioned before, also a large scale structure is a fundamentally three-dimensional distribution. So just at face value, it gives us orders of magnitude more information than the CMB. And in cosmology, we have a very precise way to measure the information, which we count in terms of the number of modes available to observations. And here I'm showing you how this number of modes changed as a function of year. It all starts, let's say, with the CFA survey in the 80s that Peebles participated in, and this survey, we learned a great deal of cosmology. Like, we learned that omega matter is less than one. We learned that neutrinos cannot be all of dark matter, and this was all in the 80s. And then sort of this program continued with better and better galaxy surveys, roughly up to the year 2000. And at the year 2000, another observational probe appeared, which is the CMB. And the CMB offered a steeper curve of learning information about our universe.
It's okay.
Okay, thanks. and basically, after that, we...
No, that's fine.
Okay.
It's a rainy day.
Got interested. All right. So after that, we hopped on this curve, and we continue learning the universe, well, sitting here. And you see, this was great. You know, we learned all these things, dark matter, inflation, and so on. So the problem, so we kind of abandoned this other curve that it sort of still developed. You know, we had SDSS and BOS, but they were always, in terms of the information, like worse than CMB. So the problem with this curve is that it's not really sustainable because the amount of modes that you can probe with the CMB is limited. So basically Planck has almost reached the level. So the number of modes will still increase, let's say at max, depends how you count, but let's say by a factor of 3. So this will not help you move much in this direction, right? It's a log curve. Well, it's a log scale. Whereas with galaxy surveys, in principle, we can continue extracting information on this more modest curve. But you know, there are more galaxies. Again, you have this three-dimensional distribution. There are more galaxies than, let's say, the CMB pixels down the road. So you know, in 5 years from now or so, the best measurement that we have right now is BOS. Then DESI, you know, the DESI survey is collecting data right now. Euclid was launched last year. So now we're going to basically catch up with Planck. And then in future, with more ambitious projects such as MegaMapper, we're going to significantly improve over the CMB measurements. All right.
Physical upper bound of the modes you can.
Sorry, could you say it again? Sorry, Neil, I'll come back.
Should there be, in principle, a physical upper bound of the number of galaxies?
Yeah, that's the number of galaxies for galaxy surveys. But then people are discussing prospects of using the 21-centimeter fluctuations that, in principle, will allow you to go even, like, 21-centimeter. For 21-centimeter picture, will look very similar. You know, galaxies will stop, you know, after we measured, like, I don't know, a billion of galaxies or something. And then after that, 21-centimeter will allow you to get more orders of magnitude. So in principle, if you measure in terms of, you know, numbers of modes, like there are really many orders of magnitude that we can measure that we don't have access to right now.
Will the accuracy of measuring parameters be the same, even though the numbers of modes are the same?
Yes, for many parameters, for most of the parameters, in fact, it will be the same. So like at face value, this really means that we should just like square root of the difference of number of modes will give you how much the parameters will improve, mm-hmm. right? And at face value, it really means like a revolution, because even with things like Euclid and MegaMapper, we're already going to improve by order of magnitude. Like for instance, H0, right? Right now we have a 1% measurement of H0. Already with Euclid, this will reduce to 0.1%, okay? So
why is that the number of modes seem to be the same, yeah? So why with Euclid do you measure H0 better?
Well, Euclid will measure H0 better because it has a better sensitivity to H0. Because this, for Planck doesn't measure H0, it measures the angular size of the sound horizon, which is degenerate, there is geometric degeneracy. But Euclid measures, you know, this galaxy distribution at low redshifts, and it doesn't have the geometric degeneracy because you get, you know, you can measure both, let's say, the angular size and also the redshift to a galaxy. So that's why spectroscopic surveys, as people use with the BEO studies, they more sensitive probe of H0. So for certain parameters, like H0, actually, the improvement will be much stronger. But let's say for things like primordial non-Gaussian, the improvements will be different, and it really all boils down to the counting of number of modes. But as Sergey mentioned, you know, this degeneracy orientation is also something that you should take into account. So this is like a simplified picture, I should say. All right. So of course, you know, all these promises are very nice, big revolution, but also there is a big problem. It's much harder to analyze galaxies because galaxies are very nonlinear. And this is obvious when you take a look at the distribution of galaxies from a simulation. On very large scales, you see that the galaxy pattern, it looks very much like the CMB pattern. You see over densities, under densities, same way as we see hotspots and cold spots. But as you start zooming in, you will start noticing more complicated and non-Gaussian structures. You will start seeing these filaments, clusters. So inside the clusters, you will see individual halos and galaxies. So obviously, you know, this distribution is different from the CMB, it's very nonlinear. And the breakdown of linear theory is apparent when you take this galaxy power spectrum that I showed you before and try to fit it with linear theory. And then you see that on large scales, you have a nice fit. So large scales means here are small wave numbers. So the fit is very good, but then the fit starts deviating from the data. So this is how you see that nonlinearities are important. And maybe another point that I'd like to make here is that nonlinearity also means non-Gaussianity. And that also says that any optimal analysis must include some non-Gaussian statistics, right? Something that we didn't really care much with the CMB because all the information was in the power spectrum. Here, a lot of information is beyond the power spectrum. All right. So let me say now a few words about the different sources of nonlinearities. So here I'm showing you again this plot that I showed before, well, this snapshot from a simulation, ElasticsDNG. So on this snapshot, the gray structure corresponds to dark matter structure, you know, dark matter nonlinearities. So this is the first source of nonlinearity, dark matter over densities. Then on top of that, in yellow, you see these clumps of simulated galaxies. You know, these correspond to the baryonic matter that we actually see in the galaxy survey. And then you can see that it kind of matches the dark matter distribution, but not completely. So if you find a strong overdensity of dark matter, you also have an overdensity of galaxies. But you also have some places, like, I don't know, for instance, if we take a look here at this void. So we see a lot of dark matter structure in here, but not many galaxies, right? So this correspondence is not one-to-one. And so it's also nonlinear. And this is something that this correlation between dark matter and galaxies, we call it the galaxy-dark matter connection. And in terms of EFT, that I'm going to discuss in detail shortly, basically we described it as follows. We said that the overdensity of galaxies that we see, so on very large scales, it should be linearly proportional to the overdensity of matter. So this is the simplest function you can write down, right? And then you Taylor expand over the density of matter. And then as you Taylor expand, they will appear, you know, they appear, let's say delta squared is next to linear order term. And then you have to write down other terms allowed by symmetry, such as the dependence of the galaxy distribution on the tidal field. So this thing should also be there. There is no reason for it not to be there, and it has to be there. So this is how we describe this. And basically here, the EFT means that something that we don't know, the function of, you know, delta galaxy is a function of delta matter. We just write down all possible operators on the right-hand side that are allowed by symmetries. And then there are more nonlinearities. There are more sources, such as the baryonic feedback, retrospective distortions. But conceptually, you know, the way we deal with this is very similar. All these sources of nonlinearity, they are secretly some functions of the dark matter over density, and we write down all possible operators allowed by symmetries, basically Taylor expanding this functional dependence. And another point that I would like to make here is that this expansion comes with a bunch of nuisance parameters that parameterize our ignorance about the galaxy formation physics, about the small scale dynamics. So those, in this particular example, are called nonlinear bias parameters. Yes.
The non-local effects of dark matter has been excluded in this simulation.
Has been excluded.
Excluded.
Sorry, could you repeat the whole?
Non-local effects of dark matter in this distribution.
What non-local effects do you mean?
For instance, the pattern that you see in somewhere would be the effect of dark matter in somewhere else.
Oh. Okay. This distribution, you're talking about causality, right? So one of the assumptions we made here, well, this expansion is basically also based on causality, right? Dark matter can affect things on large scales, on different places, right? But the speed with which it affects things should be proportional to sound speed of dark matter, which we know is zero, right? So the only way to couple different regions of space is through gravity. And this is all incorporated in this expansion. So yeah, we took into account. That's a brilliant, yes, there's also light. We were sort of sloppy about light here, okay? We could include light. Light will cause us many, many problems, okay? Let's ignore light for a moment, and then I can tell you how we deal with light. Good. So, all right, we've discussed these sources of nonlinearities. By the way, this is all well known. So here I'm showing you the measurement of the galaxy power spectrum with one of the first data releases by Bose. And you see that already here, like the same picture is apparent, that we have some data, and if you try to fit it with linear theory or represented here by solid red lines, so linear theory fails. And you need to introduce some, you know, nonlinear models, okay? And so back then, people try to, you know, come up with, like Max Tegmark, they try to come up with some simple phenomenological fits, like this would be like a k-square correction on top of the linear matter power spectrum. But it was already clear that, you know, more sophisticated modeling was needed. And already in the era of first precision spectroscopic surveys, this problem that the theory error is much more important than the statistical error of the data, so this problem was appreciated. And because of that, the standard approach until recently was to, well, instead of like modeling, which was sort of uncertain, to focus on observables that are stable with respect to nonlinear effects, such as baryon acoustic oscillations and something that's called redshift space distortions. And basically, in this way of doing things, focusing on some invariant quantities, we had to, well, the astronomers, they had to discard the shape information because there was no reliable way to incorporate it. But this also meant that we could not really measure the cosmological parameters directly like we do with the CMB. And this decision that was made back then, it impacted how different surveys contributed to our knowledge of the universe. So here I'm showing you the two papers, two great measurements that appeared at the same time. One is the Planck results of cosmological parameters that contains, you know, the CMB results, they contain the limits on all the fundamental parameters, such as the density of cold dark matter, density of matter, you know, H naught, and all that. And at the same time, there was a very great, very precise percent level measurement of baryon acoustic oscillations from Bose. But however, they quoted only the BO parameters here, right? So, and that's why, well, the volume average distance to the galaxies, to the BO. So you see, it's very well measured. It's very nice, very precise, but it's very, you cannot directly relate it to the fundamental parameters you want to. And even though, you know, BO and RSD, they have been foundational to the field, somehow there was always this story that large-scale structure were like inferior. They were more like helping the CMB, right? They were not taken at the same on the same footing as the CMB. And one of the motivations for my research was to get more information, so beyond the CMB and RSD. But for that, we absolutely have to understand how to deal with these nonlinearities. And historically, there have been two ways. One is to run simulations, like in-body simulations. And this seems to be a great idea for matter clustering, because for matter, we know the UV model, you know, just n-body, you know, n particles interacting by Newton. So we know the full model, it's great. And it works on an unlimited range of scales. We know, you know, gravity is Newtonian. On very small scales, it's all good. The problem is to put galaxies into this picture, because for galaxies, we don't have a full first principle model. And also, it has always been time-consuming to produce a simulation for a given set of cosmological parameters. Now, recently, there has been a lot of progress with using ML methods, but it's still more time-consuming than, you know, let's say, running the Boltzmann code and calculating everything in 1 second, as we're used to in the CMB case. An alternative to that was to use perturbation theory, basically take into account the fact that like linear theory and data deviate not so much on large scales, okay? So we can account for the difference perturbatively. And obviously this could not go on forever, you know, at any scale, because on small scales everything is super nonlinear, so there is no hope for perturbation theory. But for the scale where perturbation theory works, in principle, in theory, it guarantees very high precision and accuracy. And also, it's very fast and cheap, so we can calculate nonlinear corrections in a matter of 1 second. And also, as I said, it's a very natural setup to marginalize over gastrophysics, right? All these uncertainties of galaxy formation that are all encapsulated in this EFT coefficients. Yes?
Sorry. Gastrophysics is galaxy astrophysics?
Well, gas. Gas astrophysics.
Astrophysics, yeah. Gas.
It's well, here I'm using it as a label for everything, right? It's because, you know, what is a galaxy? Okay, bunch of gas, bunch of stars, right? Okay, it's all in here now. Okay, it's gastrophysics for me. I mean, stars are also made of gas, so it's okay. All right.
So maybe I want to object a little bit. So when they say there's no galaxy formation, well, the simulations, I guess there are different descriptions for galaxy formation.
Right.
So in some sense, it's similar to marginalizing over gastrophysics, because if you have different descriptions for galaxy formation, you could argue it's like, basically, I mean, the kind of gastrophysics that you marginalize over is still a choice. And I guess what I'm saying is doing different kinds of feedback is similar to marginalizing over.
Right, but sometimes, you know, people are discussing, I've seen many discussions like, you know, whether abundance matching has some component that like a hydrosim doesn't or stuff like this. So like what physics goes into the simulations is still being not completely fixed, right? And this is something that within the EFT we can say like we don't really care about at all what happens. You know, there should be some B1, B2, BG2 on large scales, okay? So in this sense, it's the more flexible. Yeah, understand that once you fix a model, then you can vary like the subgrid, you know, parameter of simulation in this, within this model. But EFT is more flexible because it doesn't make any assumptions at all. Rather than like the only assumptions that it makes is just on large scales we have symmetries and Taylor expansion.
There is an assumption in EFT that all the terms that you're ignoring are negligible, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We make an assumption that things are perturbative, right? But okay, this is something at least we can check if it's true. Or not easily. All right. So at this point, actually coming back to your question, I very often get questions like, why do, especially for people who work with galaxy formation, why do formals work at all, right? Because, you know, galaxies are so complicated. Why can I write down any equations? And at this point, yeah, I'm using this slide. I'm bringing this example of description of water, right? Because also if you look at water microscopically, you know, it's a bunch of different molecules, there are complicated forces, but I know that on large scales, all of this doesn't matter. I can just write down my coarse grain variables such as density and velocity, and I can develop my fluid description. I can have my viscosity terms, and in principle, if needed, I could include higher order coefficients, higher order viscosity operators. And again, I have some sort of Taylor expansion here on the right-hand side, and it converges as long as the typical scales I'm interested in are smaller than the mean free path of molecules. So we have this nice scale separation. So this is the regime we're interested in, and this is the regime which is hard. And we have a lot of data in this regime, so we can take, you know, advantage of the scale separation and build our EFT description. So basically, the fact that hydrodynamics, you know, was developed much before people discovered molecules, you know, kind of gives you the idea that all these complications, again, on large scales, they don't really matter. And in terms of flash case structure, we have the exact same picture. We also have some scale separation that we can benefit from. So this distribution I showed you before has, well, roughly, we can identify two scales. One scale is the scale of the halo, let's say a few megaparsec, 5 megaparsec, 10 megaparsec. So this is the scale on which complicated physics takes place, and I have to, strictly speaking, resort to galaxy formation simulations. But however, on large scales, the distribution of galaxies, it behaves like a pressureless fluid. So in principle, now we can develop some fluid description for it just because these complications don't matter. And it's very important that this description is also non-relativistic because the relativistic effects, they become important later on when I hit the size of the Hubble horizon, few gigaparsec. And this idea to develop the fluid description is known for galaxies is known as the effective field theory of flash case structure. So it was put forward more than 10 years ago. From my side, well, with Sergey here, we developed a description called time slice perturbation theory, which is basically a path integral formulation of the same ideas, where we can calculate different galaxy observables perturbatively in terms of Feynman diagrams, and something that I'm going to show you on the next slide that allows me to get a 0.1% precision understanding of galaxies. So once we have put all these things together, all these theoretical ingredients, you know, all these loop calculations, now we can fix the discrepancy between theory and data, and we can fit the galaxy power spectrum really well. And as I mentioned, as long as perturbation theory works, we have a systematic way of improving things, improving our calculations, so we can go to two-loop order, three-loop order. We can also calculate three-point function, four-point function, and so on and so forth. And some of these calculations are, well, here you can check my GitHub page. And yeah, now it's a big field to develop these codes, and there are some other codes in the market as well. So I guess one caveat that I should mention here is that all these higher order calculations, it's true, we can do them, but they will come with free coefficients in front of them. So at some point, there will be, you will face the problem that you will have more free coefficients than data points. But we're not there yet. So right now, for us, still data is more constraining than you know, theory systematics. So another question that you know, people ask me, are we sure that this EFT description is correct? Yeah, as I mentioned before, from the math point of view, it seems to be, you know, the only option. But, you know, in practice, there are many complications that, you know, there are some assumptions that we made, like, you know, perturbativity, for instance, right? So in order to convince people that EFT is correct, we did several explicit checks that here I separate into two things. One is a blind challenges, and another one is the EFT at the field level. So in terms of blind challenges, the first one was organized by Masahiro Takada and Kahiro Nishimishi. So they produced a set of high-resolution mocks. So here you see the simulated data that they produced. So it looks like the data from BOSS, but the error bars are 100 times smaller. And the challenge was to recover the true cosmological parameters that were masked. They were unknown to us. And you can see here that the error bars are really very tiny. So basically, the error bars are 0.1%. With BOSS, our error bars are like 10%. For comparison. So we took this data, we fit it with EFT, and we recovered true cosmological parameters with sub-percent precision. And this was, for us, a great way to see that what we're doing actually makes sense. So this is one check. Of course, you could say that in principle, you know, we have all these fitting parameters, all these free coefficients. Here we have like 20 data points, we have 10 nuisance parameters. You know, maybe you just got lucky with your overfitting. All right, so to rule out this possibility, we also performed EFT at the field level, because at the level of the fields, we don't have any freedom, right? The coefficients in front of these operators are unknown, and we can vary them. But the phases of the fields, we don't have any free parameters to fit for them, right? It's something that should come out of the theory. So here, what I'm showing you is the one picture is the result of the actual galaxy formation simulation, and the other one is the result of the analytic calculation using the EFT. And again, the phases here, they match, you know, these two pictures, they seem to match quite well. And we had zero parameters to match the phases, right? And, well, by the way, okay, looking at this picture, could you tell me which one is the EFT and which one is the full simulation? Any guesses? Can help you maybe. So EFT at some point breaks down, right? So on small scales, this should be
the right one.
So the right one is what? Is
the EFT.
The EFT.
More power at short scale.
You're saying this one has less power?
It looks like it.
Rolls power on small scale. Yeah, let's see. Okay, that's right. That's right. Yeah, you can see more. EFT gives you a very small scale fuzzy picture of what is going on, right? Like very smooth. It doesn't really capture some protohalos, but it doesn't capture small scale structure. So this plot has much more pronounced large scale structure. Sorry, small scale structure. So that's why it's a full simulation.
So I'd imagine that these EFT terms just like blow up, you know, towards small scales, and so I could easily imagine that the EFT will have like way more small scale power. I mean, yeah. So this has been smoothed, I guess, on some scale, right?
Well, it's smooth on some scale, but much smaller than the scale of the halo. Well, the thing is, you know, when you have, for instance, when you form, okay, how do you form, let's say, a cluster through merging stuff, right? And this effect is totally absent in the EFT. So in fact, through actual gravitational evolution, you're going to produce more massive halos. It's true that some halos you will still produce in the EFT. Like here, we still have some halos, right? that only come from the initial conditions, basically. If you just say, look, things moved a little bit and grew a little bit, so some of the hells you're going to capture this way, exactly as you say. Like, those are the EFT. The density contrast here is quite large, is exactly what you're saying. But then there are other channels to form hellos that are sort of absent here, but are present in here. So that's why it has more rich physics on small scales that helps you build things. All right, so very good. So it all worked very, very good. So this story emboldened us, and in the end, we analyzed the available data with our pipeline. We calculated, we produced the measurements of the galaxy power spectrum with our own estimators. We don't trust anyone, everything we did ourselves. We produced the galaxy power spectrum. We measured the bispectrum for the first time. We also included this in our pipeline. And we obtained some results for the cosmological parameters. So you can see the contour plot here on the left, so on the right of this, left from me. There are two. Also here, I'm showing you the results from Planck 2018, which is our benchmark. And I guess there are two points that you can make here. First is that roughly the contours, they sit on top of each other. So we didn't detect any strong tension between the data sets. And the second observation is that for some of the parameters, actually, our precision was comparable to that of Planck, like, for instance, omega matter and H naught. And this, by the way, you can see already, coming back to Sergei's question, you can see why is that. Because there is no, for CMB, you have this strong geometric degeneracy, and that's why your final constraints are much worse than the principal component. And you don't have that for Bose. So even though Bose has nominally worse statistical power, it's like worse in experiment, you see that the principal component is much worse than Planck, it doesn't have the degeneracies of the CMB that helps you measure H naught almost as good.
So let me ask you about tensions.
Yeah. Yes, I didn't want specifically to mention them. Good. Because here we assume that everything is lambda CDM. So people say, look, of course you assume lambda CDM, of you got lambda CDM. Right? What if you consider some, as we know, there are tensions, there is a Hubble tension, there is a sigma 8 tension, by the way, that you also see sort of here a little bit, like as a 2 sigma effect that we kind of confirmed. The thing that we did, we also explored, we did the fits of both with other cosmological models, the ones that people proposed to resolve the tensions, and we found that, so Hubble is extremely robust, even in extended cosmological models, basically Hubble stays like 68 or something, but for sigma 8, if you go beyond lambda CDM, actually, you're going to start detecting things. My next slides will be about that. We detected axions. Yeah. Right. Okay. So yeah, as I was saying, we had many different applications. Extensions of this. We tested, standard extensions like, dark energy, dynamical dark energy curvature. Also, we studied dark sectors, various realizations of the dark sectors, and inflation. So you remember I mentioned some great machine learning examples. So this is one of them. We generated an image of Gauss inflation, and we put it in our paper that we posted on the Halloween, but the reference somehow didn't like it. This is a good, machine learning, people have different opinions on this. So this one was not liked, yes.
So in practice, how many nuisance parameters are there? Because these bias functions, these are functions of Z.
Yeah.
So do you treat them as a single number? That's the median redshift, or do you need this one, or just how many are there?
So right now, for each redshift slice, for each redshift bin, we have 10 nuisance parameters, and we don't assume any correlation between them at different redshifts. And even for different slices of the data, so as you remember, Mina was asking this question, we have like two chunks of the sky at the same time. So at the same redshift, we have two realizations of galaxies. Even for them, we keep two different sets of nuisance parameters because the sky is slightly different. So our selection, we're seeing different galaxies, right? This is what we, even if our telescope is the same, right? So it's 10. In this analysis, that will be like 40 nuisance parameters.
So we have quantifying the dilution of your constraining power by having such a large parameter space that you're marginalizing over?
Yes. You can easily quantify this by running the Fisher forecast. I have some plots later. We lose a lot. We could have measured H naught, like our constraint of H naught are not constraints of the vision are not limited by the number of moles. They're limited by us marginalizing, by this not absence of knowledge of the nuisance parameters. We could know H-naught twice better if we had a better handle of the nuisance parameters.
What's the worst nuisance parameter that's most degenerate?
Well, it depends on a particular one. For H-naught and omega matter, this is the amplitude of the stochastic shot noise contribution, right? We know like it should be 1 over n bar in principle, but then there are all these effects of exclusion, so it fluctuates a little bit, and then it looks similar to the variation of the shape due to change of omega matter. So for these parameters, this is the most harmful one.
For your analysis, what kind of priors do you assume on those, or do you need to?
Right, so we're doing Bayesian analysis, we assume priors. I think that first time we assumed like absolutely no priors, and then our results were even worse. But then we realized that you can put some physically motivated priors that are, you know, driven by the assumption that, let's say, all these operators should be perturbative, so these coefficients should be like order one numbers, right? They cannot be 1,000, like, because if the coefficient is 1,000, the perturbative expansion doesn't make any sense. So right now we're using this like order one. Let's say each parameter varies from 1 to 10. This is a rough idea how we fix them. Well, right now I'm actually working on like extracting these parameters from simulations, from different kinds of galaxy formation simulations, to like more informed way to do it. So that's also possible. All right, so coming back to this dark sector. So I selected one particular new physics direction that to highlight here. So I started with this, you know, different, well, dark matter city, right, with different houses here. And the one, well, as you know, for each of this model, we have great constraints that come, that are, well, can be shown in plots like this, where we show some sort of a coupling constant as a function of the mass, and we have exclusion plots, well, here for the dark photon, and here for the cross-section of interaction between protons and dark matter. You know, a lot of parameter space is ruled out, and you see a lot of cosmological limits like Lyman alpha, CMB, Milky Way satellites. So this is all good. However, you know, when you look at this picture with different houses, I guess one question that you should ask is the following: why do I have to pick only one house? Like when I have a city, I have all these things at the same time, right? So why dark matter should be only one thing and not many? And in fact, if you go for this option, if you say, look, let's assume that, you know, dark matter has multiple components, many of the constraints will be gone, and a lot of cosmological constraints will be gone, because there, many of them were based on the assumption that 100% of dark matter is this particular, you know, let's say in this plot, dark matter interacting with baryons, 100%, okay? So if you leave this assumption, things will change. One very well motivated example of this is Axiverse. Right, when basically that is saying that we should have many different axions at the same. We should have many different dark matter components with different masses at the same time. So let me particularly say a few words about this model. If we have this model, we can derive very good constraints for galaxies. We cannot really do anything much with the CMB, just because, again, CMB is mostly sensitive to the total density of dark matter, not the different components. With galaxies, we're different to different components, especially if some of them is not exactly cold. So here I'm showing you the like a toy realization of this scenario. It's a toy Axiverse model with two axions. So basically, one axion is the usual axion with very small mass. So it has some effective Jeans scale beyond which it will not cluster, the Broglie wavelength, and then the other axion, let's say it's just called dark matter, its mass is high enough. So in this case, what you will see is that the galaxy power spectrum will be suppressed, and there will be two parameters, well, with respect to the one of lambda CDM, and this suppression is characterized roughly by two parameters, is the place where the suppression happens, that will tell you what is the mass of the particle, and the amount of suppression will tell you the abundance. And well, you can see that this effect is perfectly well. You can probe with the current error bars, and this is something that we have done with Kia Rogers and Alex Lager. So here I'm showing you the results of this study. So here, along one axis I have a log of axion mass. So again, I assume there is a cold dark matter component and some axion that contributes a fraction of dark matter. And this fraction is shown here on the y-axis. You know, and as a function of mass, this, you know, constraints can be different. You can be sensitive to different effects. And I'm showing here the results that we extracted only from Bose, then only from Planck, 2015-2019, and from Bose plus Planck combined. So on their large scales, the axion will start behaving not like dark matter, but like dark energy. So you gain, you get, you know, constraining power on it through the CMB again. And that's why we have very strong CMB limits, not so strong Bose limits. But then when you go to small scales, the story of, you know, CMB losing sensitivity to dark matter fluctuations, it becomes relevant. For instance, if you take a look at the dark matter mass 10 to the minus 25 EV, then you see that basically Planck cannot constrain these models, but Bose provides you with some meaningful constraints that less than 50% here of the axion should be, well, you should have less of 50% of dark matter in the form of these axions. And when you actually combine CMB and Planck, in many cases, you have very significant improvement. Like, for instance, in this parameter range, 10 to minus 28 electron volts, you have an order of magnitude improvement when you combine Planck and Bose. So altogether, just tells you that with this full shape analysis of the galaxy power spectrum, we can cover a significant portion of parameter space of the axion models that was not accessible before. And well, here it's hard to rule out new portions of parameter space because it's a log. Well, you see here in this parameter, in this plot, well, you have a log scale. And well, basically, this already means like a factor of something, right? So we were able to improve just with the usual publicly available Bose data obtained 10 years ago, we're able to significantly advance this exclusion regions. All right, and then in principle, I have another example that sort of goes along the same direction, is the tests of dark matter interacting with protons. And this is something that is motivated by direct detections. And we know that it's very challenging to probe dark matter whose mass is, let's say, less than one GeV, but you can do that with galaxies. And in particular, well, we had this sigma A tension, like a two sigma effect. And you can actually account for this effect within some of these models that has a cross-section roughly 10 to minus 25 centimeters square. And this is cross-section that is totally not covered by the direct detection experiments, just because the mass here is very small. So you can roughly detect it at the two sigma level. So well, you can see it here. Of course, I'm not claiming that we have detected this interaction, even though, you know, it's an uncovered portion of parameter space. For me, it's more an illustration that we are sensitive to these scenarios that, you know, CMB is not sensitive to, that direct detection is not sensitive to, and so on and so forth. And hope that in the future we'll you know, understand better if this is real or not. Okay, and this was the work done by student Adam. Yeah. Yes.
So your take is H naught don't buy.
Yeah.
And the sigma 8 could be something, there could be something there. It's a two sigma effect.
Right.
So what are the chances? Forget about models. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what are the chances that this will become, I mean, for astrophysics, I guess the standard is three sigma force. I mean, is there a chance that this will be more confirmed in the future? What is the problem?
Well, we with DESI, we'll measure sigma 8 to 1%.
So that would be a factor of 10?
That will be a factor of 10. So right now, all these, you know, measurements, let's say that sigma 8 is 10% low, right?
Okay.
So this will be either like a 10 sigma effect or it will
or
be
it
gone.
It will be gone. Okay.
Right.
So we will know very soon, basically.
Yeah, yeah. That's why already this year, there should be DESI year one release.
Oh.
And they will have... This will not be 1%, but this will be like, I don't know, 4% or something like this. So this will already be very competitive. Yeah, very competitive.
So can we hear any rumors?
I keep asking all my DESI friends, but they're like, no. Yeah.
So the scales over which that's being measured, you know, similar to the scales over which CMB lensing already has very tight constraints?
They are. Yeah, there is an overlap, but the scales are slightly different. I have specifically at some point like a picture that shows this. But most of this, okay, it's actually interesting that a lot of, so this effect is like, well, actually slightly stronger than 1 sigma. Most of the low sigma 8 effect that I showed you before is like 2.5 sigma. Like 1.5 sigma actually comes from large from these scales that you cannot fix. So this already tells you that at least 1 sigma of that is a systematic effect, right? Okay. From what we have now. Okay, and like 1.5, okay, this is like 1.5 effect. Okay, 1.5 could be, you know, this, but maybe we don't know. Well, here, to increase the probability, I combine it with the SIT measurements from DS, right? But they cover, yeah, they cover this range. So Bose alone doesn't detect it. It's only Bose plus, Bose alone shows you this yellow contour. So you have like a 1 sigma preference or something like this. And then you make it 2 sigma if you combine it with weak lensing measurements. Because weak lensing measurements, they roughly start here and then they go to smaller scales.
By weak lensing, you mean like galaxy weak lensing as opposed to CMB lensing?
Yeah, galaxy weak lensing, not CMB lensing, yeah. Right. Okay, so yeah, I also wanted to say a few words about inflation, that we can probe inflation here. You know, with inflation, we can play the same trick. We can work out some EFT based on symmetries. And then with galaxies, we can actually put constraints on those coefficients of the effective field theory of inflation. And we have done that with Giovanni Capas and Oliver Philcox. We derived this. And we have more results to come on multi-field models. So if you have any questions about this, please let me know. But I'm running out of time, so let me just say that in future, again, all these results are going to improve by a factor of 5 or even 10. You know, if MegaMap was improved, factor of 10 or even more than that. And with that, let me summarize my talk. I hope I have convinced you that EFT is a robust tool to analyze large scale structured data. We have cosmological parameter measurements compatible with the CMB. We also have novel tests to test physics, like this, you know, mixed dark matter models. Okay, something that is new. And we expect big improvements in the future, with which many order one questions about dark matter, inflation, will be answered. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Any more questions?
You have to assume a cross section to calculate the power spectrum of the interacting dark matter. So you calculate the cross section from like an operator that you use to calculate.
So could you say this a little bit louder?
Do you need to assume a cross section first in order to calculate the interacting dark matter?
Yeah. So we start with this. We sample it. Like as a parameter, we start with this. We calculate, you know, CMB power spectrum, the dark matter power spectrum. This is what you see for the. This actually, I think, like maybe a dark matter power spectrum, right? And then we plug this in our galaxy power spectrum pipeline to calculate the galaxy observables.
Any right.
So, I mean, that cross section is very large and the dark matter is very light. Like, do you have a model for?
Well, you tell me. So again, once this is gone, you know, only 10% of dark matter interacts. So this, I feel like you will be here, right? It's a region that is excluded by the CMB naively, but not anymore if it's 10%. So it's totally uncharted region. If you tell me what model this could be, this would be great.
Constraint like collider.
Yeah, well, direct detection, you see, it's not, there are no constraints, on this, there are no constraints. On slightly lower cross-section, there are mini-Boolean constraints, there are also xenon constraints from cosmic rays, but this cross-section is too large to be constrained, for instance, with xenon, right, so.
I think Mark was asking a question about cosmology.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, this is a huge cross-section.
Yes.
This is like nuclear.
Nuclear type.
Yeah, it's a huge cross section. This guy will be in at least in kinetic equilibrium at the time of UPN.
Right.
So the question is, do you guys have a particle physics model that gives you this?
Well, not that I know of. I mean, I can tell you from the it's a velocity independent cross section, right? So, it's like if you have a massive. like a vector boson that you integrate out, and you will get something like this, right?
Well, if you have a massive boson that you integrate out, then you have a good discussion.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So on that note,
thank you.